You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Girls Interrupted by Evgenia Peretz. Despite her isolation, the relationship was evident to many, as it would be with Fairs. He was always with Hillary in the book locker room or the hallway, says Joe Zuber, class of 07. People would talk about Hillary having an affair with Mr. Rutledge. In the fall of Simon's senior year, her friend Allison Gluick walked in on her and Rutledge in one of his study halls to find them cuddled together, his hands up Simon's shirt. Simon ran out of the room, but Gluick remained and laid into him. "I'm going to report you," Gluick recalls, telling Rutledge. "I saw what you did. I'm going to tell the police." Rutledge went at her, telling her that he'd ruin both her and Simon's chances of getting into college. "Nobody's going to believe you, and Hillary won't say a word." Gluick broke down in tears and left. Walking through the campus, the sobbing girl was spotted by the college counselor, Sarah Verdon. An outsize force at the school, who'd been there since the 90s and whose lifeblood was girl drama. According to several alumni, Verdon often had certain girls over at her apartment, adjoining the dorm, to watch TV and hang out in the evenings. Gluick told her what she'd just seen. Verdon asked no other questions and curtly replied, "You should be in your room." Verdon did not respond to a request for comment. Several months later, on Simon's graduation day, a similar incident occurred. Another classmate walked into a classroom and saw Simon and Rutledge kissing. Simon says she had been crying about leaving him, and he had just told her he loved her. The classmate reported the kiss to the dean of students. According to Simon, who later learned about the turn of events, this time word got up to the assistant head of school, Jenny Chandler, as well as Norris, who called him in. Rutledge denied it, and they accepted it. He promptly told Simon that he would commit suicide that day if she admitted to it. But no one from Miss Hall's ever followed up with Simon or notified her parents. Chandler could not be reached for comment. Rutledge, then 43, first had sex with Simon on a mattress laid out on the floor of the New York City apartment of his best friend, Joshua Green, editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. She was 17, still a virgin, and had just graduated. Green did not respond to request for comment. The promise of romance turned dark. As with Fairs, it was animalistic and forceful. As with Fairs, after he finished, he told her not to worry that he'd had a vasectomy, but it could be reversed if she ever wanted to have a child with him. After the act, she recalls lying in a fetal position, distressed and confused, against the cold tile of the bathroom floor. That set in motion a hellish next several years of dark hotel rooms, the bedroom of his school-owned home, his car tarps that he would put out in the woods, back to Josh's apartment. "My childhood bedroom, college dorm rooms," says Simon. As with Fairs, he'd take Simon to the North King Motel, where he dressed her in the same childlike 90s, read to her from Where the Wild Things Are while she lay on his naked body, and filmed her while she gave him oral sex, something to remember her by. As Simon moved into her 20s, around the time he was first beginning to groom Fairs, a tragic kind of clarity came over her one day after they'd had sex in the woods near his house. "I remember seeing this black snake near the tarp and just feeling this deep, deep sadness. And I realize now I just felt so lost. Is this what love is supposed to feel like? Is this all that I deserve? I realized I was now completely stuck in this secret world with my former teacher, and I just wanted something normal in my life, like a relationship without power imbalance, something I didn't have to hide from everyone, where I didn't feel just isolated in some secret bubble with this man, and I could stop lying to everyone and to myself. Even after she tried to pull away, he monitored her from afar, demanding long emails. When she graduated from law school, an event which was live-streamed, he zoomed in on her and emailed her a video with the message, "I'm still paying attention." Now, upon sharing their stories, the women wept together, not just for what they went through with Rutledge, but for the school's inaction in protecting them. The day after the women spoke, Simon called Rutledge in what would be their last conversation. It seems he was still hoping to manipulate her into feeling sympathy for his plight. "I'm glad you and Melissa have each other now," he told her. "I'm in absolute crisis. This is an existential dilemma for me. It was my fault for losing my mind and for the way that I feel affection, the way I feel love, which is clearly so wrong." He acknowledged that Norris and Chandler knew about his actions, and he seemed to be passing on some of the blame to them. "I think the school should have let me go," he said. For Fares's part, she waited to see what Miss Halls would do with the information she'd given them. Heaton had assured her that they take these matters very seriously. A week later, Heaton sent a short letter to parents announcing Rutledge's resignation and acknowledging his 32 years of service in many roles. No mention was made as to why he was departing. It was a gut punch to Fares. With the support of her lawyers, she steadied herself, went on to the Miss Hall's alumni page, and shared her story. Simon followed 2 weeks later with her own. Alumni poured out their support to both women with messages of encouragement and statements of regret. "We all knew," wrote Okichi Davis, class of 08. "We all heard it through the whisper channel when we were there, but it was just never confirmed." As Davis says today, "We didn't have the language to describe child abuse." The dam has burst. Judging by the accounts of other Miss Hall students, Rutledge's alleged victims date back to his arrival at the school in the early 1990s. One woman who asked not to be named recalls how he asked her to meet him in the TV room in the basement. She remembers hugging him there and feeling his penis against her, and him touching her vulva and breast over her clothing. He'd sometimes drive her off campus, where he'd put on her seatbelt for her, touching her breast. When they were spotted upon their return to campus, she became nervous that she'd get in trouble and told the head of school at the time, Trudy Hall, about their drives off campus. Hall, now deceased and no relation to the school's founder, told her to keep her mouth shut. Another student from that period recounts how she was virtually parentless when she arrived at Miss Hall's, and Rutledge, then a dorm parent, was the only person that actually hung out with me and asked me how I was doing. On Parents' Weekend, as she watched a movie in the basement TV room, he came in, cuddled up next to her under the blankets, told her how sad it was that her father wasn't there, and then had sex with her. The next morning, she was bleeding and went to the nurse. "I just had sex with an adult," the girl, then 16, told the nurse, not wanting to get him in trouble. "We don't say things like that," replied the nurse. She gave her pads and sent her back to the dorm. Rutledge continued having sex with her, including in his own house, while she was hired to babysit his children. To call out his behavior was to risk punishment. In 1997, Norris's first year at the helm, student Lisa Fagan blurted out in her senior class meeting that Mr. Rutledge effed a fellow student. Fagan says she was thrown out for slander. Silence and silencing continued to be the order of the day throughout Norris's tenure. In 2009, student Bethany Fusini, Fares' friend, told Norris she suspected that a different teacher was involved with a different student. She says Norris promptly led an assembly about the evils of gossiping and expelled Fusini. It was always about saving the reputation of the school when other things would happen, says a former teacher. I remember being in a faculty meeting and being told by the head of school, do not talk about this outside of this meeting. This is the school's business, and do not even talk to your spouses. On that spring afternoon in 2008, when Norris sat across from Fares' parents and told them how important Rutledge could be for their daughter's future, she made no mention of a letter she'd received from the parents of a recent grad. Not anyone mentioned thus far. In the letter, they informed Norris that their daughter had spent her sophomore year getting close to Rutledge, and that recently he had visited her at college, where his behavior became unmistakably inappropriate. She was not physically harmed, however. She is very upset, and so are we. The parents added, as we must deal with the consequences of this breach of trust, we know you will want to take the necessary steps to protect other young women and their families from this experience. According to one of the parents, Norris called them in for a meeting and focused on whether they intended to sue. They assured her they did not. Norris said she would take care of the situation, but she never followed up. Perhaps that's why Rutledge tended to speak so highly of Norris, often remarking, according to Simon, she's always treated me so well. By 2022, Miss Halls had dressed itself up with the trappings of female empowerment. The school had a new younger head, Heaton, and a new motto, Be Bold, which was slapped on its website and capital campaign material. Some alumnae who had suspected Rutledge's misbehavior and been moved by the hashtag MeToo movement took that motto to heart and felt the time had come to say something. Not only was Rutledge still teaching there, he had been given the Leonard Family Teaching Chair Award, which honors a faculty member who possesses the highest personal and professional ethics. At the 2022 reunion, Rutledge, red-faced and drunk, stumbled around the reception hall, according to Sushil Sinha, class of 00, a member of the alumni council. She then joined a group of women spanning a dozen years at Miss Hall's who were discussing their sexual relationships he'd had with their former classmates. Sinha was hearing this all for the first time and became alarmed. The following morning, Sinha reported what she'd heard to Heaton. According to Sinha, she looked me in the eye and said, I want to know what's going on in my school. Sinha believed the matter would be dealt with. But by reunion weekend 2023, which featured guest speaker Lucia Evans, Rutledge was still working at Miss Hall's. Mary Adamsick, class of 03, who won an alumni leadership award that weekend, confronted Heaton with the same information that Sinha had a year earlier. Are you aware of this? Adamsick asked her. Adamsick got the impression that Heaton was hearing this for the first time. She just looked at me like a deer in the headlights and shook her head. Heaton told her it wasn't the right time to talk, but to call her at a later date. When Adamsick tried to reach her the following week, Heaton didn't return her call. During that same reunion, Adamsick asked Verdon, who'd allegedly turned away Simon's whistleblower 20 years prior and who was now dean of students, why a sex abuser was still working there. According to Adamsick, Verdon replied, I don't see anything, I don't know anything, I don't say anything. And it doesn't seem like Rutledge was deterred all the way through the 2024 school year. Jessica Gleason, a parent of a class of 27 student, reports that Rutledge lavished attention on her daughter last year. After Gleason pulled her daughter for the following year, the school refused to return her deposit. According to a 2024 graduate, Rutledge was still testing the waters as late as last spring, with his hands lingering for too long on girls' shoulders, for example, and sitting uncomfortably close. After Fares and Simon went public with their stories, Ms. Halls made a statement acknowledging Rutledge's misconduct and notified the authorities about Rutledge. In early April of last year, it hired a small, Maine-based law firm, Alita Law, to conduct an investigation. The school declined to answer Vanity Fair's questions, citing that investigation and providing a statement that read, in part, "We are fully committed to learning the truth about what occurred so that we may extend support to anyone in our community who was harmed and continue our efforts to safeguard our students today and in the future." Still, members of that community feel the school has fallen short. Faculty member Robert Bolger, who shared check-in duties with Rutledge in recent years, says that he learned about what had happened from local news reports. Concerned, he went into Heaton's office to discuss it. She nervously asked him if he was investigating. Bolger resigned at the end of the school year. "Most galling to Fares and Simon is that the school has yet to establish a therapy fund for Rutledge's survivors." This, in part, prompted Fares in October to file a civil suit against the school and Rutledge. In October, the Berkshire County DA's office announced that it would not be filing charges, citing the age of consent in Massachusetts, which is 16. Fares was in her bed when she read the news online. "I curled myself up into the smallest ball I could and wept. But then she got up and closed the chapter on that girl. No more feeling small," she told herself. Through her lawyers, she told the DA's office that she did not accept the decision that rape is rape. After a subsequent meeting with Fares, the police announced that the case was ongoing. Though it's unclear whether charges will ultimately be filed, her fire is undimmed. "It's so clear to me now what I deserve, what survivors everywhere deserve, what is just and what isn't," she says. "Once you gain that kind of clarity, there's no erasing it or looking back." Sure. Let a neighbor use the guest room for a few nights. What could go wrong? A lot, as a series of unsuspecting residents learned after one woman allegedly exploited California's tenancy laws to turn casual stays into protracted eviction wars in an exclusive Malibu enclave. The Squatter of Point Doom by Bradley Hope Tom Wright. On a cool September evening in 2021, a 65-year-old artist named Alden Marin took a stroll down to the majestic beach at Point Doom to take in the sunset. The beach itself is public property, but the easiest ways to access the best parts are through private land owned by the residents of this upscale stretch of Malibu. In practice, its miles of picturesque cliffs and pristine coves are among the most exclusive preserves in California. Owning a beach key to one of the accesses is a serious status symbol. It means you're a local. You belong. On this particular evening, Alden would later tell his sister, he encountered a quirky, energetic, middle-aged woman. She had shoulder-length, frizzy brown hair, piercing blue eyes, and a British accent, and she introduced herself as Ellie Mae McNulty, an actor and screenwriter. Alden, who had graduated from Stanford and attended the Sorbonne before running a successful wine business, had been battling stage 4 melanoma for the past 3 years or so. The diagnosis and subsequent chemotherapy had left him struggling with major depression and distress, so their conversation was a welcome respite from the isolation of the pandemic. He'd see McNulty a few more times over the next month, on the beach, as well as at the supermarket and other shops in town. They became friendly, and McNulty suggested they attend an art exhibition together. Then, according to Alden, about a month after their first encounter on the beach, McNulty mentioned that she was looking for a place to stay for a few days while waiting for her next residence to be finished. By the end of their chat, Alden would later recall he had invited her to stay at his two-bedroom condominium for a few days until her new place was readied. What could go wrong? She must have a beach key or be close to someone who does, he thought. For Alden, a sensitive painter and poet, the excitement of having some companionship overcame whatever doubts he harbored. She saw in my brother a kind of perfect storm, says Alden's sister, Mindy Marin, a veteran casting director who has worked on such films as Clear and Present Danger and Thank You for Smoking. She has this actressy English thing about her, super flirty. She's just got it down, especially the men, by being this English rose. Soon, though, the mask came off. Alden and his family say, in the months ahead, they claim, McNulty would unleash a campaign of psychological terror that helped land him in a medical facility while she changed the locks. About a month after she moved in, McNulty's demeanor changed dramatically. Alden would claim in a request for a restraining order. She began berating him and ridiculing his medical problems. Alden said she took videos on her cell phone, threatening to use them as leverage to stay longer. He found himself relegated to one room in the downstairs area of his own home, unable to access the kitchen or other areas without enduring McNulty's verbal abuse, according to his declaration. I felt alone and isolated when I was forced to retreat to my downstairs bedroom, and I felt that her comments and abuse were setting me back in my recovery, he said. In her response to the court regarding the allegations in Alden Marin's submitted declaration, McNulty said it was Alden who had pursued her on the beach and invited her to dinner at his condo. I am a single independent woman, and Mr. Marin drove me home after I said no to going to dinner and no to going back to his condo, she wrote to the court. And she said the Marins had changed the locks on her while all her home belongings were still inside. She asked to be repaid the $468 she said it cost for a locksmith to let her back in. The fateful decision to let McNulty stay, Alden later told his sister and other family members, was a life-altering miscalculation. Mindy Marin wanted justice, but soon found out that California's tenancy laws weren't in her favor, even in what seemed to her to be an open and shut case. And as she shared her story with friends in Hollywood, Mindy soon learned that her family wasn't the first to succumb to McNulty's charms. McNulty, who, according to her LinkedIn page, had come to the United States in the 1990s to make it as an actor, was working from a playbook she'd honed over more than two decades. Mindy didn't know it yet, but she and her brother were dealing with someone with an apparently deep understanding of how to exploit California's liberal tenancy laws. A picturesque promontory jutting out into the Pacific, Point Doom isn't an obvious target for those looking to take advantage of tenancy laws. Its seclusion, breathtaking views, and proximity to studios and networks in Los Angeles have made it a magnet for Hollywood A-listers. Bob Dylan has an estate here, and Martin Sheen owns a mansion above the beach. Other celebrity residents include Julia Roberts, Sergey Brin, and Rick Rubin. It's a community of high-powered people who you'd think wouldn't be easy to take advantage of. And there are few families whose Point Doom roots go deeper than the Marins. Originally inhabited by the Chumash Native Americans, Point Doom was named after Francisco Dumetz, a Franciscan missionary who came ashore in the late 18th century. For the next two centuries, the land at Point Doom, windblown and treeless, covered with scrub, was mostly used for cattle ranching. By the 1930s, stars of Hollywood's golden age, like Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor, had begun building homes in the area. The Marin's ancestors, who were in show business, settled in Malibu. As Hollywood's influence grew, so did Point Doom's reputation as a haven for the rich and famous. The area's modern-day residents are no less insular than their forebears. They prefer to keep the beauty of its coastline to themselves, via the system of locked gates. Only the owners of houses on certain streets have keys to the gates, which can add millions to a property's value. Seeing McNulty on the beach put Alden at ease. Tourists couldn't get there easily. And McNulty, then 46, seemed at first like a perfect guest. She was solicitous with Alden, making tea and sharing her passion for yoga and meditation. A couple of days of idyllic novelty turned into a week, and then 2 weeks. The excuses for why her new rental wasn't yet available started to pile up. Checking in on her brother, Mindy felt something was off right away. "Oh, she's okay," Alden told Mindy, she recalls. "She helps around here. She makes breakfast. She makes sure I'm okay." But something didn't sit right with Mindy about this new person in her brother's life. She started to dig. A brief search of Ellie Mae McNulty on the internet seemed to confirm she was a filmmaker of some kind, or at least identified as one. McNulty's social media was peppered with photos of her with well-known Hollywood players, David Lynch, Al Pacino, Jim Carrey. Amid the customary feel-good aphorisms, impossible is just a big word thrown around by small men, she posted about her work in progress screenplay, a romantic comedy, and her membership in the Screen Actors Guild. On July 3, 2021, just months before she ran into Alden on the beach, she had Instagrammed a screenshot of a New York Times review that noted her exceptional acting in an off-Broadway play, along with a photo of McNulty and others on stage. What she didn't mention was that the play in question had been staged in New York in 1998, almost a quarter of a century earlier. It all seemed a bit phony to Mindy, who is on a first-name basis with many of Hollywood's top actors, agents, and executives. She'd seen plenty of pretenders in her long career, but she was busy casting Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1, so she put her worries aside, though not before telling her brother they could hire live-in help if he needed it, rather than rely on this discomforting stranger. "I don't like the sound of this," she said. On day 31 of her stay with Alden, Mindy says, McNulty's behavior abruptly changed. Suddenly, she started telling him what to do in his own home. A sensitive individual who avoids conflict, he started to fetch her things. She even got access to his credit cards after he left them out, according to Mindy, and apparently used them for household expenses and food for the house. He was scared, Mindy says. Since the arrangement had originated as a favor, McNulty never paid any rent, according to Mindy. Later, when they pressured her to leave, McNulty claimed she was waiting for an inheritance from her grandmother before she could pay for a new apartment rental, Mindy says. At one point, Mindy called her brother to advise him on how to extricate himself from the situation. She says McNulty forced him to turn on the speakerphone, then said to Mindy, "How dare you talk to me about that?" The problem, the Marins soon discovered, was that the law was on McNulty's side. California has long been a tenant-friendly state. State law mandates that guests who occupy a room in a house, even if they are not paying and have no contract, can be considered tenants at will. While there are no hard and fast rules governing how long it takes to establish informal tenancy, McNulty's behavior in Alden's home suggests she considered 30 days to be sufficient. Landlords in California seeking to evict unwanted guests like McNulty must go through a formal court process, which can take months. The state's laws were designed to prevent landlords from unfairly evicting renters. Reached for comment, a spokesperson for the California Department of Justice noted that not paying rent, being a nuisance, and engaging in criminal activity on the premises are all considered just cause for eviction under state law. But some tenants are exploiting California's laws for personal gain. One Airbnb guest in Los Angeles refused to vacate the premises for 570 days without paying rent, and the company now advises hosts to limit stays in California to 28 days. Hotels sometimes re-register long-staying guests to prevent them from establishing tenancy. To protect landlords from at-will tenants, rental agreements in California stipulate that guests should not stay at a property for more than 14 days in a six-month period or for more than 7 consecutive days. But Alden had no formal contract with McNulty and no awareness that she had become a tenant. Successful, smart people get fleeced because they have no idea these laws exist, Mindy says. As Mindy learned the details of the laws, she realized she was in for a fight. Her brother's fragile state and what the family saw as McNulty's increasingly aggressive behavior emboldened her. Mindy says McNulty then began to trash the place, flushing cloth napkins down the toilet, blocking the pipes, and leaving feces in the toilet bowl in what appeared to be a show of spiteful defeat. Others have used such strategies to make landlords appear negligent. In the case of the overstaying Airbnb guest, the fight began over water damage in the bathroom that the landlord said was not there when he rented the unit, according to the Los Angeles Times. The tenant stopped paying rent and contacted the Los Angeles Department of Building and Safety, which found 2 code violations, including failure to obtain a permit to install a shower. A judge later ruled that the tenant could not be evicted as the unit had been improperly listed. She requested $100,000 in relocation fees from the landlord, but finally moved out after he refused, the Times reported. At the time, the Marins were not aware of how difficult and costly rental laws can be to navigate. The combination of Alden's recent battle with cancer and the turmoil at home took a toll on his health. On January 11, 2022, according to a court filing, Alden was taken by ambulance to Sherman Oaks Hospital's psychiatric unit. He was diagnosed with major depression and a possible psychotic break, which he attributed to the threatening presence and worsening conditions and abuse imposed by the respondent, causing extreme pressure on me as I merely attempted to live in my own house. While her host was gone, McNulty allegedly changed the locks, another right afforded tenants in California. According to Mindy, McNulty ignored request to leave the house and hand over the keys. In his court declaration, Alden said she texted his family, saying she didn't want him to return to his home and insisting she could heal him through transcendental meditation taught by her friends. She even requested $12,000 from the family as a loan to vacate the premises. She stole the place out from under him, Mindy says. In a rage, Mindy started to dig deeper. Next, photo claim to fame. On Instagram, Ellie Mae McNulty, pictured here, liked to call attention to the off-Broadway play she'd starred in back in 1998. But her acting career never took off. Searching online, Mindy pieced together a rough outline of McNulty's life history. She was born in 1975 and grew up in Oxley Hall, an area near London where Henry VIII once had a hunting lodge. Her father, a communications consultant named John McNulty, had been a director of Mensa, the British-based organization for people with high IQs, but he reportedly resigned in the mid-1990s amid a scandal over expenses. He denied wrongdoing, and no charges were filed. McNulty attended private school, where she fell in love with the theater after a trip to see The Taming of the Shrew. "Found my real home," she later wrote of the experience. "Spent the rest of my life doing my best to get back there." After high school, McNulty moved to London to pursue her dream of becoming an actor while taking a series of jobs in related fields to pay the bills. According to her LinkedIn profile, she built props and painted sets for the BBC, worked for Ridley Scott's commercial production company, and became a projectionist at a movie theater. Then, like many aspiring British actors, she tried her luck in the U.S. In 1995, she enrolled as a painting and sculpture student at the Art Students League of New York, according to her LinkedIn page, then got a foot in the door on Broadway as a production assistant with Wait Until Dark, a play remembered, if at all, for Quentin Tarantino's wooden performance. Outgoing and vivacious, McNulty got to know the right people, or so she claimed. Tarantino taught her New York slang during rehearsals, according to her LinkedIn, and a top Broadway producer hired her as a script reader, providing feedback on new plays. She also began to hone her acting skills. In 1998, she auditioned for the New Group Theatre's off-Broadway production of a British play called The Fastest Clock in the Universe and landed a leading role as a streetwise 17-year-old Londoner. According to one person involved in the production, McNulty struggled during rehearsals and clashed with the female director. She spent several hundred dollars on a pair of shoes to wear on stage, according to the person involved in the production, then burst into tears when she was told that the company didn't have the money to pay for such expenses. But she was cute and sexy, the person said, and with coaching, was able to pull off the role. Reviewing the show for the New York Times, critic Peter Marks called McNulty a real find and said she possessed a wild cackle that pitches upward into the range of dog hearing and the kind of pluck that helps explain why the British triumphed in two world wars. Her career, he wrote, is no doubt in ascendance. My dream came true, she later wrote, working New York City actor. After the Times review, Sam Cohn, one of the city's top talent agents, took McNulty to Michael's, the Midtown Power Lunch Spot, and signed her up, said the person involved in the performance. He said, I was going to be a great artist, McNulty wrote on Instagram in January 2024. McNulty said Cohn set her up with an audition for the female lead opposite Nicolas Cage in Martin Scorsese's next film, Bringing Out the Dead. At the audition, Ellen Lewis, Scorsese's longtime casting director, asked how, with so little experience, she'd managed to secure Cohn as her agent, McNulty wrote in the Instagram post. Before she even let me read, do my work, I was intimidated and simply said quietly, he came to see me in my first lead role in a play with a new group. In the end, the role in Bringing Out the Dead went to Patricia Arquette. Today, McNulty regularly tags on social media people involved in that theater performance from more than 20 years ago, a reminder, perhaps, of the path her life could have taken. Instead, Cohn soon dropped her, says the person involved in the performance. McNulty got a job reviewing screenplays for Ben Barinholtz, a Hollywood producer, according to her resume, and continued to audition for acting parts. In 2003, she landed a minor role in The Suite Life, a low-budget film about a bartender who falls in love with two brothers. From there, things seemed to unravel. She married a British fashion designer based in New York, but soon divorced him. She held down jobs for only a year at a time, according to her LinkedIn page. The film failed to propel her acting career. And so, in 2004, she headed to Los Angeles, still hoping to break into show business. Now on the cusp of her 30s, her new dream apparently was to make it not as an actor, but as a screenwriter. It's unclear when McNulty began actively trying to exploit California's tenancy laws for her own benefit. Shortly after arriving in L.A., she answered an ad for a room to rent. Two young women living in an old house in mid-city were looking to sublet a spare bedroom. It was a bit of a last-minute thing, says one of the women, Polly Orchon, a film and television producer then in her 20s. According to Orchon, McNulty spent a lot of time in her room. When she did socialize with her housemates, she had a habit of bringing up her divorce. She made it out like she was this poor victim, Orchon says. Helpless me, feeble, silly, fragile me. She always used the British thing because Americans are quite stupid when they hear a British accent, she adds. I'm like, oh, that doesn't work with me, sweetie. I lived there. From day one, according to Orchon, McNulty complained that the room didn't live up to what had been advertised. She asked them to reduce the already below market rent, Orchon says. On Halloween night, Orchon heard the door click and a taxi pull away. McNulty had cleared out, leaving her housemates on the hook for 2 months' rent, according to Orchon. She actually was exceedingly calculating, she says. It was only a matter of a few $100s. They tried to get the money from McNulty by filing a small claims lawsuit, but records show that the case was dismissed by court order. Still hoping to break into Hollywood, McNulty sought to cultivate relationships with powerful figures. She met the director David Lynch at a museum event and began practicing transcendental meditation through his foundation, according to her Instagram. But McNulty has, on occasion, oversold her career as a screenwriter and overstated her relationships with celebrities, which mostly amounted to passing encounters and photo opportunities. She claimed in one email to a landlord that Mike Medavoy, the legendary producer involved with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Terminator, was paying her for a script she was writing. That was a mirage. Michael Lee Peterson, vice president of development at Medavoy's company, Phoenix Pictures, recalls taking one call from McNulty years ago, but says they had no plans to work with her. In reality, McNulty appeared to be struggling. A few years after her Halloween night disappearance, McNulty rented an extra bedroom from a writer and filmmaker named Jason Gervitz and another roommate. At first, McNulty was sweet and seemingly innocent, Gervitz recalls. She failed to pay the security deposit or any rent, but said a relative would be sending her the money soon, so she moved in without paying anything up front, Gervitt says. But then it went on, and she kept avoiding us. And it became pretty obvious 2 months in that this was a scam, Gervitt says. McNulty, he adds, would play dumb while attempting to gaslight him and his roommate. This time, there would be no sudden departure in the middle of the night. Instead, Gervitz says she told him to his face that she wasn't going to pay or leave. "I've been here, and this is where I live now," Gervitz recalls her saying. By this time, according to L.A. court records, McNulty had been involved in at least 4 tenancy lawsuits. Some of the lawsuits are sealed, but at least one eviction case was dismissed by the judge. The law, it seemed, was in her favor. Gervitz contacted everyone he could find on her Facebook page and began collecting stories. In one, McNulty had allegedly stayed at her yoga teacher's house without paying rent. She didn't pay for classes either, it was claimed, but continued to show up for them all the same. When confronted, her bubbly persona would evaporate, Gervitz says. Although an eviction can take months in California, there are ways to speed up the process. One is to get a judge to issue a civil harassment restraining order, which allows the police to intervene. Even then, Gervitz was told, the LAPD is not permitted to forcibly remove a resident. Instead, they have to persuade the tenant to leave the home, at which point the landlord can lock the person out. That's what happened to McNulty. According to Gervitz, the police asked her to step outside to discuss the civil disobedience ruling he had secured. And once she came outside of her own volition, and she was basically with the officer, he wouldn't let her go back inside, Gervitz says. Enterprising adversaries like Gervitz are a headache. McNulty moved on to a widow in her 80s who was looking to rent out a room in her Santa Monica bungalow. It was a cute house with a small garden surrounded by trees and flowers. The details of the lawsuit the widow brought against McNulty in 2016 are sealed. According to a source with knowledge of the situation, the widow was so emotionally distraught by the ongoing legal fight that she agreed to pay McNulty tens of thousands of dollars to leave her house. By then, it's possible Los Angeles, the scene of so many legal battles, was losing its luster for McNulty. Or maybe she wanted to move to even nicer surroundings. Whatever her motivations, McNulty, like many wealthy Angelenos who tire of the city, set a course for Point Doom. After her brother's breakdown, Mindy Marin began to search legal records involving McNulty. She says she was surprised to find more than 10 cases stretching back almost 2 decades. The most recent were all in the Point Doom area. One of them involved Roger and Natasha Honan, who decided to rent a room attached to their garage in late 2019 after Roger lost his job. The Honans found McNulty on a Facebook group that connects would-be tenants and landlords in the area. Natasha says McNulty identified herself as an English actor and said her house had burned down in the fires earlier that year. Slowly, the penny dropped in about 2 days that something's not quite right with this girl, Natasha says. McNulty, she adds, made elaborate excuses for not making rent and sulked when Natasha refused to lend her a family car. Some of McNulty's behavior was just plain weird, according to Natasha. One day, she looked in on the apartment and saw a 3-foot-high pile of torn paper in the center of the room. Her behavior inside the main house was even more unnerving. "She'd come into the kitchen while I was cooking and creep up right behind me," Natasha says. Sometimes late at night, they'd hear McNulty tiptoeing onto their floor to do laundry. To protect themselves, they placed an old cowbell on the door from her apartment to the house, but she soon figured out how to enter without making a sound. One night, McNulty slammed a door and ran away after Natasha demanded the rent, she says. That's when Natasha began digging online and found evidence that McNulty had been wrangling in court with landlords since before she moved to L.A. I realized that she had started doing it when she first landed in New York City 20 years ago, Natasha says. She's been doing this her whole life. Ironically, it was the pandemic that gave the Honans the opening they needed to successfully evict McNulty. Their daughter had health problems, and McNulty's refusal to get vaccinated was putting her at risk. Meanwhile, employees at Point Doom Village began to take note of McNulty. Staff at Le Café de la Plage and the town's high-end shops came to know her as an eccentric who walked her cats on leashes on the private beaches. She would order coffees and then ask others to pay, or simply make no attempt to pay at all. McNulty often posted about how much she loved the land around Point Doom and how blessed she was to live in such surroundings. She dreamed of getting back to the success she'd enjoyed in 1990s New York. Amarjit Singh Marwa, a 98-year-old retired dentist whose patients once included Gregory Peck and Elizabeth Taylor, lives in a mansion in the hills behind Point Doom. He says McNulty turned up at his door one day and asked permission to set up an art fair on his lawn. He agreed, but the art didn't sell. Eventually, Marwa says he gave her a few $1,000, money he considered a charity donation. Later, McNulty moved in with another family who rented a bedroom in their house to her in 2021. She refused to pay and stayed there for months, a family member says, leaving only when the sheriff forcibly evicted her. That's when she encountered Alden Marin on the Point Doom beach. After Alden was allegedly locked out of his apartment, Mindy vowed to fight McNulty in court. At one point, she says, McNulty offered through an intermediary to leave if she were paid $20,000. She figures out you hate her so much. You're afraid of her. You want to get rid of her. You don't want to go to court. You don't want those months of your life, tormented, torture, and everything she knows she's subjecting you to. So she'll hope you're going to pay just to get her out, she says. This time, though, McNulty's gambit didn't work. She knew that Alden had the background. She knew that Alden had the backing of me, who was unrelenting, and his brother, and that she was going to see us in court. And she knew that we had a pretty good case, Mindy says. McNulty had also made a misstep. She'd asked for the $20,000 from the Marins as a way to pay a deposit on her next place, a property just east of Point Doom near Barbara Streisand's mansion, according to Mindy. She'd provided the banking details of the owner, a retired schoolteacher. And the agreement is she's got her next grift lined up, like the poor schoolteacher that we unearthed because she was stupid enough to give me the bank information because she was starting to panic, Mindy says. Instead of paying her to vacate Alden's place, Mindy decided to pass a warning to the prospective landlord about McNulty. She never moved in. In early 2022, the Marins went to court in Los Angeles. Alden was shaking in his boots, his sister says. At one point, according to Mindy, McNulty stepped into an elevator with them and proceeded to pursue the family around the courthouse. She tried to follow us through stairwells on different floors. We had to wait in a parking garage, she says. It was nuts. Eventually, a judge ordered McNulty to vacate the premises. They threw the book at her, Mindy says. But somehow she must be staying somewhere right now. For all we know, she's got a new victim. By the end of last year, McNulty's whereabouts were unknown. She'd been spotted a few times in Point Doom's shopping center. A manager at Le Café de la Plage Malibu said she'd been banned for harassing customers for free coffee. A security guard for the shopping complex said he'd been told to keep an eye on her. She was making fewer appearances at the cafe or the nearby Pavilion's supermarket, and she wasn't seen much on the beaches either. And so we sent her a text. Hi, is this Ellie? "Hi, yes, this is Ellie," came the reply. "Please, could you remind me where, how we met?" At first, she was cordial, sensing, perhaps, that there was something to gain from the interaction. But after it became clear she was the subject of an investigative report about her disputes with landlords, McNulty obfuscated. She declined to meet or answer questions. Eventually, she wrote, "This article will be continued in the next installment." This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.